This is At School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have three sponsors for the show. Those are EasyGrade, Jam Software, and XMA. We'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. Bradley, good evening.
Fantastic to be back. Part six of our deployment series. Been a fun series so far. So glad.
Thank you for keeping me straight on the number.
Yes, number six. Yeah, get it out there early so you know. This week we have a fun topic as well. This is, I think, one of those that a lot of teachers are concerned about, and this is just something that has a lot of discussion, and it's accessories and apps. But before we get started, we do want to take a moment and thank the people on our Patreon list who are sponsoring us with a $10 or more donation. So, Fraser, do you want to thank those folks for us?
Surely, yeah. We have four people or four organizations to thank. The first is Envision Design, LLC, Michael Slade, Nicholas Cole Farrell, and Thomas Vershorn. Three people in one organization who are doing a great job of supporting this show. So thanks to them. And if you want to join them, you can go to patreon.com/outofschool and you can sign up to be a supporter of the show there. Thanks for your support, guys.
And the people who are supporting us with a $3 or more donation, there is a page on our website called the Dean's List, and those folks will be listed there every month. So, again, thank you for that. We've kind of worked through our thought leadership, our network, our device selection, and then we kind of come to accessories and apps. And accessories obviously will compass a lot of things, and then there'll be cases and any other thing like that, extra batteries, and then of course apps are really fundamentally probably what kicked off the iPad craze in schools. Without the apps, it's really just a web browser that doesn't have Flash.
I think the thing about apps is that what gets individual teachers wanting the iPad in their classroom, because they see an app or multiple apps that they think can do something very useful for them in the classroom. And that's what leads them to think, well, maybe we should get this platform to get those apps. And I want to try and offer perhaps a slightly different way of thinking about that problem that will help you sustain your thinking about apps into the long term. But I think it's always the number one question that people ask, particularly people kind of new to the idea when they come to visit us. They're asking us what apps do we use and so on. So it's something that we will definitely talk about, but I want to try and, if it's not too grand a term, put together a philosophy of app use.
Absolutely.
In school that I think will, because we can tell you a set of apps today, and then a year from now, is that still useful content? Maybe, but I think we can do better than that. And I want to give teachers and school administrators the tools to think about apps and which apps are the most powerful, which kinds of apps are the most powerful for use in the classroom.
Sounds perfect.
Okay, so I think the first thing I would say is that every beginning school in an iPad deployment goes kind of app crazy, and we certainly did as well. And slightly in our defense, one of the things about the 2010 era was that apps were much weaker then than they are now, because iOS was weaker, the devices were weaker, and a lot of those things were coming over from iPhones. And those were reasonably early iPhones. The iPhone 3GS was kind of current at the time. And those apps didn't do very much. And quite often what you'd find is one app did one thing. So you'd have a specific app, for example, I think there was an app called Color Splash back in the day, where you could basically do a Schindler's List effect on a photograph. You could monochrome most of it and paint out an area where that wouldn't be applied, for example. And nowadays that's just one feature in a much larger app, like Pixelmator, for example. But what we came to understand over the course of, I would say probably the first 3 years of our deployment, so up to 2013, maybe 2014, we rolled back and back and back and back from going app crazy on our devices. And what happened there was firstly the iOS and the iPad got more powerful, but also the individual apps got bigger and more powerful as well. So you went from having an app like Color Splash to eventually having iPhoto for iOS and eventually Photos for iOS, which are much more comprehensive apps, kind of like what you would find on the Mac, really and truly. And this kind of crystallized for me when some colleagues of mine were visiting a school abroad, and they were doing a sort of consulting thing with that school, And the way they did this consulting was that they took my colleagues and they sat them in the school library. And what they did was they just sort of ran a clinic for teachers. So this school was about to go one-to-one iPad. And they would sit in the library and teachers would come in and they would ask them a question and they would go away again. And as my colleagues were sitting there, a teacher rushed in, obviously quite harried. And she sat down, sort of dumped her stuff on the table and said, "Look, quickly, you need to tell me what's the best app for volcanoes?" And my colleagues sort of looked at each other and they said, "Well, we're not really sure. That's not really our area." One was an art teacher and one was a primary school teacher. But when they came back and they recounted that story to me, the thing that I understood was that it finally clicked in my head that many teachers were thinking about apps in exactly the same way that they would think about textbooks. So that she was asking, what's the best app for volcanoes? She was thinking about that in the sense that, well, I'm going to take out a textbook and I'm going to substitute an app for a textbook, and then I'm going to teach about volcanoes through the app rather than through the textbook. And it's kind of a natural question to ask, because the textbook, particularly in secondary school, the textbook has kind of been the thing that conveys the education, if you like, or at least codifies it in some way. And what I realised was that we need to think about apps differently. And that sort of came along at the same time as me thinking about how we deploy apps in school. And what I came to realise was that the phrase that I eventually used was that apps are pencils, not books. And teachers, too often I find, are thinking about apps like textbooks. And what they need to do is they need to think about an app like a tool, like a pencil or a ruler or a rubber or a pen or a paintbrush or something like that. So that was the insight I had a couple of years ago, and I've sort of worked on it since then. And in a recent presentation I did for Apple in Edinburgh, I finally sort of connected all the dots, I think. And what I did there was I looked at a thing called Bloom's Taxonomy. I don't know if you're familiar with that, Bradley.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Yeah. Bloom's Taxonomy it's been around for a long time, and it's something people maybe had one lecture on at college when they were training to be a teacher, but it's not, I wouldn't say it was universally used as a guiding standard for what we do in schools, although some teachers are very keen on it and some systems use it more than others. And what Bloom's Taxonomy sort of states is that there are multiple levels of cognitive skill, and some are better than others, basically. Or they're better might be the wrong word, but they're what they call higher order skills, and other skills are lower order skills. So what Bloom's Taxonomy does is it identifies six different cognitive skills, and it declares that two of them are lower order skills, and four of them are higher order skills. And what we look at that, the way we look at that is that the remembering and the understanding skills are lower order skills, and the higher order skills are called applying, analyzing, evaluating, and synthesizing. And when the iPad first came out, you saw a lot of kind of infographics online about Bloom's Taxonomy in the iPad. And what people were doing was they were taking these six areas and they were sort of assigning specific apps to these areas. So, for example, iTunes U might be an understanding app, and Keynote might be an applying app, and Pages might be an evaluating app, and GarageBand's a synthesizing app, and so on. And I came to realize that I found those wheels of apps not very useful. And the reason they weren't very useful is because it was clear to me that many apps, and increasingly many apps at that time, crossed over multiple boundaries. And what I realized was that there was a category of apps that you could basically place them into every segment of that wheel, and it would be relevant to put it there. And there were, of course, other apps that are more useful for one or two particular areas. But first of all, Bradley, let me, for people who are not familiar with Bloom's Taxonomy, just explain what those six levels are. Remembering is about exhibiting memory of learned materials by recalling facts, terms, basic concepts, and answers. Okay, it's a basic kind of question and answer quiz type stuff that you do in school. Understanding requires you to sort of organize, compare, translate, interpret, give descriptions, and state the main ideas. So change the content in some way or restate the content to demonstrate that you've understood it. And that's a valuable thing to do as well. So it's not like these two lower order skills are not valuable, they are. But then there are other skills above that. So the applying stage is about using acquired knowledge, solving problems in new situations. Analyzing is about examining and breaking information into parts by identifying motives or causes, making inferences, finding evidence to support your generalizations, and so on. And then evaluating is about making judgments about information, validity of ideas, or quality of work based on a set of criteria. And finally, synthesizing is about building something new, right, or putting parts together to form a new whole. And that's, in some ways, in some conceptions of this, it's described as the highest level skill. And there's some debate about whether evaluating or synthesizing is the most important thing. But with the big old push to creativity that we had a couple of years ago, it was sort of decided that, you know, creating new things was the ultimate pinnacle of education. So synthesizing sort of made its way to the top of that list. But the thing that I realized that when you're asking about an app for volcanoes, what you're asking about is you're asking about an app to cover the basic two levels of remembering and understanding. Now that's really what, and that's what a textbook can do for you, is it can help you remember and understand. And to put an app in its place, the app's going to do similar things. But we've sort of come to a different conclusion, which is to ask the question, that how does the app allow the student to express their learning? And what I mean by that is that the app is not necessarily the content, but the app is the blank canvas or the creative space where the student can do all those higher order skills of evaluating different options and synthesizing a new thing, for example, and using that to show what they've learned. And that's much, much deeper than just doing a PDF version of a worksheet through iTunes U. Does that make sense so far?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So when it comes to looking at apps, what I would like teachers to understand is that if you look at something like Bloom's taxonomy, and you could do this exercise for other knowledge taxonomies as well, it's not just Bloom's, but what I noticed when I looked at those wheels of apps that were rather arbitrarily placed, what I noticed was that there was this class of apps that you could correctly put those apps in every single level. It was useful for every single level. And those were the most appropriate, most useful, and most powerful apps to use in the classroom. So when I look at a new app, I ask myself a question like, could I use this app for analysis and synthesis? Can I make something new with this app? Or can I just look at it? So, you know, for example, if I look at an app that shows me how the pyramids were built, and it lets me take a virtual tour inside a pyramid, can I use that app for synthesis? Not really. It's just an app for, it will aid my understanding, and I may even understand better if I'm looking at it, if I take a 3D tour through it. But can I use it for synthesis? Not really. So what I do is I look at apps and I say, well, is this app appropriate at all levels of Bloom's taxonomy, or is it stuck at one or two levels? And that's not to say that an app that's stuck at one or two levels isn't useful, but the ones that are useful at all the levels are much more powerful. So let me give you two examples just to kind of make this a bit more concrete. The first example is iBooks. Now, iBooks is a great e-reader app, PDF reader app, and it works for remembering and understanding. You can learn from a book, you can understand its contents, you can use the notes feature and the highlights feature to enhance your understanding. And if you struggle with reading, you can use, you know, speak selection feature to even improve your understanding even further. It's still a boost to that. But then iBooks is not really applicable to the applying, analyzing, evaluating, synthesizing stages. It is sort of the lower order skills, if you like. But take an app like Keynote, for example. Keynote, you can use Keynote at all levels of the taxonomy. So you can use Keynote to learn content, to cover, remember. You can understand in Keynote by adding your own notes to a slide, or I've seen kids, you know, use Keynote to make their own flashcards to understand something better. You can apply in Keynote, so you can actually use Keynote to build interactive tools that you might apply some knowledge in order to do that. You can analyze data in Keynote, present a chart, present a table, use that to evaluate different bits of information. You can evaluate by, you know, creating a Keynote deck that maybe presents and defends opinions on a topic, whether that be a social subjects topic, or maybe your analysis of a science experiment or something like that, or what's the best way to solve this algorithm. You could present about that if you wanted to. Keynote could be useful there. And finally, you can actually synthesize new stuff in Keynote. So we did a great project last year with some kids where we asked them to imagine they were building their iPad into a museum touchscreen exhibit, and they had to choose the topic, and they had to do an information analysis of what were the important parts of the topic, do an information architecture diagram, and then build it as an interactive hyperlinked presentation in Keynote. And that's an example of synthesizing a completely new new learning object from the knowledge and research that the student had done before. So you see how Keynote can work at all those levels? And if you think about other apps, you can imagine other apps to do the same thing.
And then you certainly can use other apps, either only touch the, like, say, first two in conjunction with a Keynote.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that more and more what I'm looking at is a kind of suite of apps that let you build the whole piece that you're looking for. You can think of other apps that might go along with that, Bradley. So you can think of things like Explain Everything or even Pages, Numbers. Those can be used to, you know, analyze data, present a new argument about something. You can use those tools at those levels.
Well, and one of the things that, you know, our thought process has changed over the years is the role of the iPad in textbooks, where it used to be the goal was to eliminate textbooks, but then we both kind of came around to the understanding is if all the iPad is a textbook replacement, then it's only open to the books and it's nothing else.
Yeah, and the thing is, you never just go into a classroom and read a book for an hour and then go away again. The textbook is an aid to doing something else. So at the most basic level, you look at a textbook and it has content and then it has questions about the content, for example. Or you might make study notes based on the content. And in many ways, I feel that this might be a different argument under iOS 9 with multitasking. I'm not sure yet. But in sort of classical iOS usage, having the iPad as a book meant you were doing all that great work somewhere else. So you're spending a lot of money to make the book electronic, but then you're keeping around all the other stuff as well. Whereas if you maybe just keep buying the book, then you've got the iPad available as a tool for all kinds of interpretations of that knowledge, all kinds of synthesis of new information. And you can see students start to do some very interesting and creative things that show a deep understanding of the problem in there as well.
Before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It's EasyGrade app. EasyGrade is a free iOS app that gives teachers the ability to quickly calculate their grades on their students' tests and quizzes, like the old cardboard EasyGrader. Configuring it is super simple, lets you calculate grades based on the number of questions, right or wrong. You can show grades rounded to whole numbers or tenths. If you get partial credit, you want to check out the in-app purchase. You can give calculate grades based on half points. So again, that's in the in-app purchase for the app. I have a Mac version as well that was recently released. So if you want the same grade calculation powers on your Mac, you can do it from there as well. And if you're the person in charge of your school's app deployment, both of these apps are support the volume purchase program. Well, I guess the iOS app's free, so that definitely would. But the Mac app has educational pricing as well. But you can find more about the app at easygradeapp.com, or you can just search for EasyGrade in the iOS or Mac app stores. Thanks to EasyGrade app for sponsoring the show this week.
So I hope that wasn't too esoteric a discussion there, Bradley. I hope it. If I was to present you with an app and ask you to, you know, tell me how can that app be used in these different ways, I get the feeling that people could take that piece of information away and apply it to the kind of apps they have.
Yeah, so what we're not going to do here is to say, like, these are the 10 apps your deployment must have, because it might be different from school to school. And you know, we can go through, like, some of the big ones, but most of you are going to already know those. I mean, this is 2012, we might have that discussion, but you guys know about the big ones. So we're more trying to give you an analysis or a lens to view apps through as you look at how to build up your suite or your toolbox. Some other things you do want to remember, you know, when you're looking at apps, certainly if you have multiple options, some things you want to remember or just, I guess, keep in mind. How's the updates been? Like, has it been updated in the past year? If you're looking at an app to deploy school-wide and hasn't been updated since 2012, we probably should move along. You know, again, frequent updates, well-supported. Does it at least match the iOS 7 appearance? I mean, there are still apps on the App Store that still look like iOS 5 and 6. Again, probably not something you're wanting to deploy new. Do they require a recent version of iOS? So if you have an app that still requires at least iOS, say, 5.1, that shows that app's not taking advantage of the latest and greatest technologies for iOS. do they require an in-app purchase to be useful? Again, if you're doing school deployment where you're controlling the app infrastructure, you're purchasing the apps, you have no way to facilitate in-app purchases. Now, one thing a lot of apps are doing is if they do require an in-app purchase to basically be useful, they'll have an education edition as well that unlocks everything with the purchase price. So you want to check into that. I know a lot of apps do that now. Do they require a subscription or login? You know, that's probably one of the things I've seen the app infrastructure change over the years is it's moving from standalone apps to everything is hooked to some sort of cloud service.
Yeah, and the thing that annoys me about this, Bradley, is that education sort of led the way in that. So I've been using an app called Hopscotch recently to sort of teach introductory programming. And, you know, the first thing you've got to do in that app is you've got to make an account on their stupid service. You know, and it's like, come on, you know, now I've got to go and read your privacy policy. I've got to go and look at data protection. And all I want to do is, like, draw a wee square on my iPad. And suddenly I've got to be hooked into your stupid cloud service and your sharing service and everything.
Well, and I appreciate an app offering one. But, an app like that, let it work without it. Yeah. And, you know, offer the option to sign in, but let it, you know, do as much as you can without requiring it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the other thing that sort of annoys me a lot here is apps that, and there was an early app, I'm trying to remember what it was called. It was called Toontastic, and it was an app where you could basically animate cartoons on the iPad. And the problem with that was that the kids could make something, but the only way you could share it was to upload it to their thing called TuneTube, right? And it's like, you know, come on, just, you know, I just want to save that as a video. Because you don't want to be putting that out on the internet just because somebody made it and you want to get it back down onto the teacher's iPad or even upload it to the student's Google Drive profile or something like that. So that's something to be aware of as well. You know, you mentioned in that purchases as well, Bradley, that, you know that old saying about plays in the theatre where it's if a gun is on the mantelpiece in Act 1, it'll go off by Act 3, right? If the purchase page says in-app purchases, eventually you're going to be in a point where you have to buy that in-app purchase in order to get something useful done. And it's worth, if somebody asks you to deploy an app that does have in-app purchases, to go through as tightly as you can and make sure that if whatever it is the app's supposed to do, can you actually achieve it at all without the in-app purchase? Or what level of functionality does the in-app purchase prevent you from getting to? Because you're going to end up in a situation, and I did at one time where we had sort of locked in-app purchases, and then I had a kid who was sitting advanced higher computer science, and he had done all these huge big flowchart diagrams in a flowcharting app, and then at the very end it was like, oh, you need to do an in-app purchase in order to export these as images. And the kid was like, his report was due the next day, and I was like, no. So it's things like that, you know, that was a while ago. I could do a better job of that now. But just finding out where the limits are, I think, is quite important.
Well, and I think if you're an app developer, making it an app aimed at the education market, it's worth thinking through these things and how your monetization strategy can work in schools. Because, yeah, I know in-app purchase is free, but in-app purchase is a great way to work in the general app ecosystem. But if you can convince a school that's deploying 1,000 iPads that your app is worth it, and you charge, I don't know, $5 for it, you can make a lot of money pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, particularly if it's not something that, say, requires a back-end cloud service. And you know, if you figure, you know, like you're, you know, if you're for every app, you know, 1,000 apps you sell, you may get X number of support emails. Like, you can make a lot of money with very little maintenance very quickly selling apps to schools that are buying in mass.
Yeah, and the thing about selling to schools is you're not going to get 1,000 emails from 1,000 users. You know, all those people are going to ask the tech support person in their school, and then he's going to email you or she's going to email you one time, you know, to get the solution to that.
In fact, the tech person at the school will become your on-site tech support, basically.
Yeah, we should get a discount for that.
Yes, true.
I wanted to mention as well, Bradley, you said, has the app been updated for iOS 7? Now, there's an app that we deployed years ago called Moodboard. And it's a kind of digital collage app. And it still hasn't been updated for iOS 7. But it's still on sale in the App Store for $7.99 a pop. And, you know, as new kids, we've used up all our licenses for it. And teachers are coming to me asking, can I get Moodboard in this kid's iPad? And I'm like, no, I'm not spending another penny on that app because it doesn't do enough, and also it's clearly not being supported anymore. So there's no way I'm dropping another, you know, £50 to £100 on that app. So instead, I'm just telling the kids to make a single slide keynote deck. It does the same thing.
Before we move on to our second topic tonight, I want to thank our next sponsor. It's XMA. It's a leading Apple solution expert for education. As an Apple solution expert, XMA is perfectly positioned to support your institution with the deployment of iPad and Mac. XMA has built upon the 30 years of experience to create the unique All Learn program for iPad. With All Learn for iPad, XMA can help you with planning, financing, and managing your iPad deployment. XMA can also use their accredited trainers to deliver Apple professional development to teachers and staff to ensure you get the best results from your Apple products. Learn more about them and the All Learn program. Go to xma.co.uk or follow them on Twitter at @wearexma. Again, that's xma.co.uk. Thanks to XMA for sponsoring Out of School this week. So again, that's kind of our app theory. And again, this is something where take this data or what we've talked about, and then this is where you work through that as a deployment team, as a faculty, to see what you need. Yep. And so again, I've said this half dozen times over the last 3 years. You know, when I see articles, you know, or classes, you 10 Web 2.0 apps you must have on your iPad, you just want to bang your head on the table. Yeah. Or when I see
50 ways to use the iPad in the classroom.
Or when I see something like, and I see those, and I see Tumblr on it. Like, really?
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the thing about apps is that it's not that there aren't good reasons to deploy other apps. And I'll give you a counter example to what we've just said, just to kind of round this out, Bradley. Last year, I had to do an after-school club, and I wanted to do a chess club. And I got a reasonable response. You know, we had maybe 10 pairs of kids coming along to play chess. And what I did, instead of, you know, going out and buying a bunch of chess sets, which we would lose the pieces all straight away, I just deployed a chess app on everybody's iPad. And I think it was either free or £1 or something like that. But for that small amount of money, I was able to put an iPad on every iPad in the school. So I was able to buy 150 chess sets, basically, for almost no money. And what happened then was absolutely fascinating because the chess was there, there was a group of kids, not all kids, but a group of kids who every wet interval and every wet lunchtime, of which there are many in Scotland, they would sit and play chess. And then just 4 weeks ago, I started the chess club again for this year. And oh my goodness, those kids came back and like half of them were almost able to beat me. And there's a whole subculture of chess in my school that I didn't know anything about. But the kids are sitting playing chess all the time because that tool is there. It always works. It's always there. And okay, that is just, it's not a general purpose application. It's a very specific purpose application. But that's the kind of thing you can do with apps. And that's where the power comes from. And I think that's when you start to see more about that kind of culture of computer use in the school. Reaching out into lots of different things, unanticipated consequences that you would never have seen before.
Yeah, I'd think about that.
So anyway, yeah.
It's like, trying to think of a good example. It's like letting all, you know, dropping it in, see what you can, dropping an app in, see what y'all can come up with.
Yeah, I mean, and guided exploration is a perfectly good way to look at these apps as well. It's, you know, sometimes, I did this with Hopscotch recently, in the first half hour, I said, go and play with this app, see what it can do. And then bring them back together and we'll look at more formal ways to use it for learning or use it for thinking. But it is a very, very powerful way to do that.
So for the next half of the show, we're going to talk about accessories. And so we're going to talk about keyboards, Stylight, Apple Pencil, all that stuff. So we'll just kind of work through that really one by one. Accessories, keyboards. I do not think your deployment in its entirety needs everybody to have a keyboard. Is there a reason to use keyboards sometimes? Absolutely. I might say you might even have 10 to 20. I would recommend the Apple wired keyboard, or I'm sorry, like the Logitech 30-pin, or not 30-pin, but the Lightning. Yeah. You know, I think they sell on Amazon, $30, $40. Yeah, I don't think you need to buy a case with a keyboard built in. For one, you're going to have so much Bluetooth going through your room that it's going to cause all sorts of interference on the 2.4 gigahertz. But I just don't think you need it. The software keyboard will suffice for a lot of things. And then if you have a specialized application you need a keyboard for, bring those wired keyboards in and good to go. Again, I just don't think you need them for your entire deployment.
Of course, one of the situations where you might be in the situation of wanting to have keyboards is in a test scenario. So we do run some digital exams using the iPad, and that's one situation where we'll offer every student a Bluetooth keyboard. And that works fine because the numbers are small, right? You're talking 1 to 3 children per exam might be doing that in our school. But that's one of the reasons why I think the wired keyboard is a nice thing to get, is because, you know, Bluetooth, batteries, interference, all that kind of stuff, none of that is there with the wired keyboard. But in times past, I spent more time playing about with wired keyboards, and I see this happen all the time in my school, which is that a student will get a Bluetooth keyboard for Christmas or birthday or something, and they bring it in for about 2 weeks, and then they don't bring it in anymore. And what I just, my interpretation of that, and from speaking to the kids, is just that it's not useful enough for the extra weight and bulk that you're carrying with you. And that seems to be true in most cases. And always remember that you're sort of bringing these kids up to use the computer that they're using. So, you know, they will learn the virtual keyboard in a way that perhaps older members of staff, or, and by which I mean any member of staff, because they're all sufficiently older. It is absolutely a generational thing. And I've had kids program, you know, right up to advanced higher computer science, higher English, higher history, using the software keyboard, and it's not something the kids genuinely struggle with at all. And of course, if you are lucky enough to go to iPad Pro, the iPad Pro virtual keyboard is a whole step up again. It's got a number row, it's got punctuation symbols right out on the front screen. It's an even faster keyboard than before. What I would say, though, is it's worth spending a little bit of class time teaching some of the tricks for the iPad keyboard. And the reason for that is that just makes people more efficient typers. And we have spent time working on iPad typing skills. You know, we've mentioned an app before, they sponsored the show before, Tap Typing. And that's a really great way to get people up and running and typing on the iPad.
Yeah, that's a really great app. Big fan of that.
Absolutely.
So next, Styli, or you know, is that the plural of stylus? Yeah.
Styli, yeah. Yep.
I'm going to say no there. I don't think you need those really at all. Maybe get a couple for very specialized applications, but even less recommended for an entire deployment than keyboards.
Now, in some cases, I've actually made kids put their stylus away, because one of the things that I see more with beginning iPad users than older iPad users, but I've seen situations where, you know, kids get a stylus and they're sitting with one hand on their head poking at the iPad with a stylus to type. It's like, A, that is the laziest thing I've ever seen, and B, I am going to be an old man and dead before you finish writing that essay if you're going to pick it out with a stylus. I've even seen kids, you know, one stylus between the fingers of both hands, and they're using one, you know, like two fingers, but it's like, why even do that? stylus, not a big fan. Of course, Apple Pencil, whole different story.
Well, and that'll be the Apple Pen. Again, I don't think you're going to can financially afford to buy one for your entire deployment. And a lot depends on there what iPad you're deploying and if the mythical iPad Air 3 even supports it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as you look at it right now, you're unlikely to be buying even a class set of Apple Pencil, but we have posited in the past, Bradley, the idea that you might buy, say, 10 for the art classroom if you were deploying an iPad en masse that had support for the Apple Pencil, like you say, the hypothetical iPad Air 3. The reason for that is that the Apple Pencil just pairs with whatever device you plug it into to power, which is great. And I think I can see it being, you know, a class set or a few in a classroom from time to time. But you're right, the price of the Apple Pencil means it's unlikely to be added on to every single deployment you do.
Next thing is before we do that, let's thank our final sponsor of the night. It's the great folks at Jamp Software. You guys know Jamp. They provide schools with enterprise tools that power their Apple technologies, you know, iPhones, iPads, Apple TVs, Macs. If it's an Apple product, they pretty much manage it. They have a great app called Casper Focus that allows teachers to kind of manage their classroom from their own iPad, allows them to select a specific Apple TV, distribute iBooks, initiate AirPlay, and conduct secure exams. Big fan of the Casper Suite. One of the cool things you can do here in the U.S. is you can actually buy it through Apple, and you can like add that into your lease, and that's what we're doing. They have a hosted option, or you can run it on site. We use the hosted option, so I don't have to fool with it. But big fans of the Casper Suite. Only thing they do is Apple, so we had an email thread last week with some of the other IT directors in Chattanooga talking about MDM, and my point was, if you have an all-Apple deployment, Casper is where you want to go, because what's getting so important going forward is how quickly your MDM vendor can adopt new things with iOS, and Casper and Jamp Software have been right there year after year. So check them out at jampsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com.
Okay, so next thing on the list, Bradley, is should you be deploying a screen protector or not?
I'm going to say no, just because the thought of having to apply every one of those would make me crazy.
Yes, the very act of doing that would be insane. One of the things, though, and this is a little pro tip or trap for young players, put it in your acceptable use policy or your device use policy or whatever it is, that if you have to swap an iPad for damage, that you will not replace any screen protector that somebody might have put on it. The language in our policy is, you can apply a screen protector if you want, but I won't do it for you. And also, if I have to replace your iPad, I will neither supply a new one, nor will I try and transfer the old one. As long as you're clear about that, I think that's a way to keep that sane. To my knowledge, in 6 years of doing this, I don't think anybody's ever put a screen protector on their iPad. Certainly not that I've seen, anyway.
One of the things I've noticed with some staff iPhones is, like, they put on those tempered glass things with a nose crack, yep, and they leave them on. Like, you might as well have a cracked iPhone.
Where does the broken glass end and the iPhone begin?
Right. Yeah.
And the other thing is, now that we're in the world of retina displays, I used to use a screen protector, and it was one that had a sort of, it put a matte finish on the screen. That was like in the iPhone 3G and 3GS days, because those screens were not good screens, right? They were low resolution. They had a massive air gap between the glass and the LCD. And now you've got these amazing retina screens that are optically bonded to the front glass, and it's just a whole different game. And to put a screen protector on that just degrades that experience so much that it's like, you know, you spent hundreds of pounds on this device and then you're going to just ruin the screen by putting something on it. And screen protectors are only really protecting against minor nicks and scrapes. They're not protecting against breaks, really. So it's just, and some people put them on after they break the screen to hold it together.
Yeah.
That's another thing.
Yeah, I used a screen protector about that time, and like, I think maybe on my current phone, like if I turn it a certain way in the light, I may see some like surface like scratches. I can't even tell.
Yeah, I have one small nick on my iPhone, and I think I have one tiny one on my iPad Pro as well. But I can only see it in certain lights with certain backgrounds, so I'm not too worried about either of those.
So next thing is battery packs, and I've not thought about this until you put this in the notes. Could be very, very useful if a student's like kind of running low on juice and it's not near a power adapter. I never thought about that.
This has changed my life. Right? This is a pro tip to end all pro tips. Right? Maybe I can see it being a little more problematic, or you may have to just be a bit smarter in a big school. But what I've done is I've got two battery packs, and they were just, they're like 22,000 milliamp hour battery packs from Amazon. They were about £20 each. But what I did was, I bought Amazon lightning cables to go with these, because they were going to be used quite frequently, so I wanted something that was a bit more robust. And secondly, what I did was I used gaffer tape, duct tape, and zip ties to hold that cable onto the battery pack, right? So that those two things could not be separated. Because eventually you'll be, here's the battery pack, but somebody stole the cable, because people are always wanting cables. I also got the black cables rather than the white ones, so they wouldn't get confused with anything else. And my tip here is to have a little station somewhere in your classroom or wherever you keep these things that just has, you know, micro USB plugged into an adapter so that you can charge these things. But what this has done is, the people who forget to charge their iPad will always forget to charge their iPad, so it goes. But what it enables the kids, say they do, instead of having to like get, because none of our classrooms are built to have the desks near power sockets anymore. So when you're the kid who's got an iPad, you're like sitting down on the floor beside the socket and trying to do your lesson, whereas the battery pack lets them sit at their normal desk and keep their iPad going and still be part of the lesson. I suggest in a bigger school, you might have to be a bit more clever about how you stop people accidentally taking the battery pack home. And to be fair, folk have done that a couple of times in our school as well. You might have to put it in a big wooden box or something like that, I don't know. Find some creative way of making it, you know, like the toilet key, right? Which is usually on a huge big wooden key ring, just so nobody loses it or forgets to bring it back or whatever. You might have to do something like that for your battery packs as well. But, you know, in the worst case scenario, if you do lose them, they're not that expensive to replace. And they certainly make the kids' lives a whole lot easier. But I've not bought 20 of them. I've only got two for the whole school. So it's not as if you can be guaranteed to get access to a battery pack when you come to school either. It's just you might be the lucky person who's the only person who's forgotten to charge that day. Other times it might not be the case.
And these things seem like they've come way down in price over the years.
Oh, massively. But much, much lower cost, much longer lasting. And another little tip though, get one that has an LED battery capacity indicator on the case. So ours have got four little blue lights that light up to show you how much is in the case. So you don't have to, like, I've got other ones I've had before where you have to plug it into power and then it shows you how much power is left in the battery. I want to be able to look at that and go, do I need to charge that tonight, yes or no? And, you know, stick it onto charge when I go home. That's typically what I do just to make sure those things are in good shape.
So last one, we got a couple more. Cases. So cases kind of encompass quite a few different types of cases. I think you got a note here that says all cases suck, and yes, all cases do suck.
I hate iPad cases, and I hate that I have to have one as well. So this is a criticism I don't often make, but I still think it's true, is that I don't think the industrial design of the iPad is all that good. And the reason it's not all that good is because you have to kind of build it around with a case just to make it functional. And this was brought back to mind when I got my iPad Pro back in November. I didn't buy the smart cover because I hate the smart cover. But my goodness, this thing is made of like iced over soap. It's so slippery on the back. You can't rest it on your knees. You can't even prop your knees up on the sofa and put the iPad on. It slips down. You know, it is actually really hard to use without a case. Compare and contrast to, for example, the Microsoft Surface, which has a kickstand built into the body of the device, right? Sure, people buy the keyboard cover for the Surface, but you don't need it for the same basic things like, can I stand this thing up? Can I prop it in a certain position? You can do all that on the Surface without a case, whereas in the iPad, you end up having to get a case. The device is, relatively speaking, fragile, so you do need to, you know, defend it a little bit more as well. So I think there's more could be done with the industrial design of the iPad to make it not require a case as much or for as many situations, and make it sufficiently robust that I wouldn't feel too bad about just throwing this in my backpack. But at the moment, it's not designed that way. So yeah, all cases suck, and it sucks that you have to have one. But what I wanted to do, Bradley, was sort of, again, give a little theory of iPad cases, if you'll indulge me again.
Absolutely.
There are only two iPad cases. There's the wedge and there's the kickstand. And each has its advantages or disadvantages, but basically you can boil every case down to either one or the other of these things. Now, the wedge case is what you effectively get when you use a smart cover, or if you remember the traditional iPad case, where it was like it opened up like a book, but the left hand side or the front cover was had a hinge at one point, and you could sort of fold it round in two sections and wedge it into the back of the case, so that you had a very tall right angle triangle, or sort of right angle triangle, and the iPad body itself would be the hypotenuse of the triangle. And what that would do for you is you could put it into a typing position, so you lay it flat, and the iPad's in a keyboard style position. And then you could tip it up and stand it on its thin edge, and you could sort of watch a movie on it if you like. And that's quite a precarious, it's not very well balanced, it's kind of top heavy in that situation, but it does the job. And more recent smart covers are actually better at doing that. And there's many, many, many cases that will do that kind of thing. One that I see a lot of schools using is one called the STM Dux, I think it is DUX. That, and certainly in Scotland, I know that a lot of places are just saying, you know, this is kind of like the standard case for schools now. This is one we're shipping to all the deployments. So that's, we're looking at that one for our next deployment as well. What I like about the wedge is it puts the iPad on and into an efficient two-handed typing position, not dissimilar to traditional keyboard. Not so great if you need to stand the iPad up vertically, but what I've noticed is that more and more often we're not doing that so much, you know, or at least the kids are doing it, but they're not doing it to any purpose other than just to have the iPad vertical. The other advantage of the wedge style case is it's often lighter than a kickstand case because it doesn't require multiple layers of material, whereas the kickstand style does. So that's kind of what I like about the wedge. I also like it from a classroom management point of view, because when kids have got their iPad sort of low and flat on the table, you as a teacher can stand up and you can see what's going on in most screens. Of course, quite soon we'll have the classroom app to help us do that. But when you have the kickstand style case, that's a little bit harder. Does that make sense for the wedge? Mm-hmm. Yep. I would say the kickstand style case is much more, perhaps more, as a proportion of all iPad cases, it's perhaps a larger proportion. Certainly, it seems to be more commonly made for cheap iPad cases. This style is used. And I think it feeds into a use case that many people use their iPad for, which is to watch videos on, because the kickstand puts it into a very stable cinema style experience, whereas it's not so great for typing. So the kickstand, if you imagine opening a case like a book again, and the iPad's on the right hand side, what happens then is that the inside edge, the edge that's against the spine of the book, if you like, you stand that up, and that edge becomes the foot. The front cover becomes the foot, and the iPad is angled upwards with a small triangle in behind. So what you end up with there is you end up with sort of multiple layers of material, maybe two or three layers of material, in order to give you enough hinging and folding material to create this triangular stand out of. And these cases are really poor for typing. Because in most cases, they're putting the iPad at a very vertical position. So, anybody who's trying to type on it, they'll lift their hands up and they'll be typing against a near vertical surface, which is very, very bad for your for ergonomics. So it's not a great thing. And what these do is these promote in schools, and I've seen this because we have this kind of case at the moment, typing with the thumbs, right? So what I'll see is kids will stand up their iPad vertically, they'll grab it like a steering wheel, and then they'll type with two thumbs. Right, and I'm basically spending time trying to persuade them not to do this. When I got our kickstand case, I thought I was being really smart because I found this case from Belkin, which went into both a kickstand and a wedge shape. But what I discovered was that the kids are putting the kickstand all the time, and they never put it into the wedge shape for typing unless I make them do it. So we'll not be getting that case again, and we'll not be getting a case that can do a kickstand again. The other thing that's poor about the kickstand style for a classroom is that because the iPad goes up vertically, suddenly you're on the other side of the iPad, rather than when it's low on the table, you and this pupil have both got access to see the iPad screen. So it's a wee bit, it's potentially more of a classroom management problem. You have to get around behind the student to see what they're doing. Again, maybe the classroom app will take some of that problem away, but I'm much less a fan of the kickstand case than even I was a couple of years ago, having now had some experience of using them in the classroom.
Yeah, those are kind of things we really didn't think about years ago. We were just thinking about durability and price.
Yeah, and does it protect the corners, you know? Price is a funny one for iPad cases. I don't know what you think, Bradley, but I think price is almost no relation to how good or bad a case is.
Well, I guess when I think of price, I'm thinking of, like, I've got to buy 100 of these.
Yeah. But, you know, is a $50 case twice as good as a $25 case?
Not always.
Not always. It doesn't scale linearly. And I've seen some cases where people have bought cases for a lot of money, like 90, 100 plus pounds, and they're not that good at all. I mean, look at the smart cover, right? That's £50 cover. It's garbage. It's really garbage, you know? And it doesn't last at all. I mean, 3 months in, that thing feels floppy and worn already. So, yeah, this is basically just a show about how much I hate the smart cover. but yeah, I mean, the thing, I want to close out, Bradley, by talking about some things to look for in a case. because I think that, again, this is about the theory of choosing these things rather than us telling you which one to exactly get. And of course, corner protection is important, right? It's one of the most vulnerable areas on the device for drop damage is corner.
Yeah, that's kind of something that's stayed with me over the years. Is that if it's just kind of I'm not worried about the back being scratched as much as I am the corners being dinged, and that often can cause the glass to shatter.
Yeah, the amount of force that goes through that, and you know, I think we at the moment have perhaps the most vulnerable iPad that was ever designed for that. The third and fourth generation iPad with that kind of pointed iPad 2 style edge. So the actual edge of the device is extremely thin, but the device is also really quite heavy. And if you drop it in the wrong way, you can actually end up, you know, shattering the glass just because of the amount of force going through such a small area. Whereas the iPad Air design and later has got a much more kind of bull-nosed edge to it, which I think perhaps disperses the force a little bit better. So yeah, corner protection is still important. If you are doing a deployment where the kids are taking the iPad home, or if you're in secondary school where they're taking it around the school, a secure closure clasp is something that's important. It's something I've noticed has failed in many of our Belkin cases now, is there's a magnetic clasp that goes around and holds the thing shut, and many of them have just worn away to nothing now, which is great. I mean, we always say this, Bradley, don't we, that if by year three your stuff's not wearing out, you're not using it enough. So it's great to see those cases wearing out because they're clearly being used, but it's something to bear in mind because, you know, an iPad in a bag with other books and so on can cause everything to... It goes under a lot of pressure and a lot of force.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like you said, Bradley, a moderate price. Okay. I would recommend not buying $2 cases, but I would also recommend not buying $100 cases. So somewhere in the middle there, bearing in mind things like you're going to have... The case has to give its life for the device. It's going to get used daily for 3 years, and we've actually had to buy some replacement cases in the last couple of months, just to see us through to the summer, because some cases just have completely fallen apart. And of course, some people's sweat and hand grease affects different kinds of case material differently. Our cases are sort of leatherette effect, and many of them look quite shabby now. But one or two kids, for whatever reason, just the chemical composition of their sweat or whatever, just rotted those cases away. So we got them slightly more plasticky cases just to replace them. But it's just something to think about. Other thing I would say, Bradley, is moderate weight for the case. You want to be careful not to overdo this and end up with an iPad that is similar to weight to a laptop. I don't know if have you held an iPad Pro with the Logitech Create keyboard on it?
I have not.
You should, if you ever get the chance just to handle one of them, you should try it, because my goodness, that thing weighs a ton. The keyboard alone is like more, I think it's actually heavier than the iPad.
Wow.
It is insanely heavy. And the iPad, you know, so you're looking at a three plus pound unit there. And that is, I picked up the keyboard one time, I was like, that is alone more than I want to carry, never mind that plus the iPad. So I suppose maybe, you know, if you're designing a keyboard case, it's got to be counterbalanced against the weight of the iPad and so on. But the point being that it is possible to really get this wrong and buy cases that are just way too heavy. And one way of doing this, which I've seen, I suppose this is maybe a third category of cases. You know those military spec sort of defender
the
cases?
Griffin Survivor case.
Griffin Survivor, the OtterBox case, and so on. I hate those cases for school. And I hate them for two reasons. One, they are so difficult to get the iPad in and out, in large respect. And secondly, they put so much weight onto the package that it becomes an ergonomic problem for the kids to carry about and use it from time to time. So I really don't like those cases. And I've known some schools where they've had to use those cases for the insurance, but if you don't have to, I would strongly recommend not.
Yeah, it takes away from the portability. And I know a lot of parents, especially like if it's a BYOD situation where they're going into like, say, sixth grade, that they're like just super concerned that their 11, 12-year-old is carrying around a piece of glass that costs $500 to $600. And so that's like, oh, I gotta buy a big case. I see their point, but it just changes the device so much.
Yeah, and the bigger you get it and the heavier it is, in some ways, the more chance you're going to drop it. If it doesn't fit your hands anymore and it's heavy, you know, particularly if you're a younger child, it may actually cause more problems than it solves. So I'm not a great fan of those cases. I was going to say something else about that, but maybe it'll come back to me. The other thing I was going to say was that those kind of cases in particular, but other cases too, can often block ports or make access to ports very difficult. Or ones that are that try to be waterproof, for example. You've got the camera cut out of the back. There's like a little rubber plug on a flap, and you have to sort of hold that out of the way while trying to also take the picture. And if you imagine, you know, it's tricky enough to take a picture with an iPad for a kid without dropping it, but having to also hold a wee rubber flap out of the way and then take the picture, you know, these things start to cause more drop risk than they actually eliminate risk of damage when you do drop it. So those are things to think about too. Check that you don't cover the ports, the camera, or the microphones on the device as well. Those are important.
Yeah, lots to think there, because you know, with cases and all accessories, this can really add a significant amount of cost to your deployment if you want to do those things and they're not properly budgeted for.
Yeah, that is true. But on the other hand, you can also cause a lot of problems for your deployment if you don't do the right thing as
true.
Well. I mean, there was one school in England somewhere where there was a huge big newspaper scandal about it because they had broken 50% of their iPads in the first year. And what happened was that they had bought a case that was not a good case. I don't know what case it was. I don't know how much or how little they paid for it, but they had bought a bad case. And as a result, they were experiencing a lot of breaks of their devices. And they changed the case. They just replaced them all with something else. And their breakage rate dropped to about 2%. Which is what the similar thing to what we see. So that's a case of getting it badly wrong with the case. And it is important to sort of, how'd you get it right? I don't know. But, you know, I suppose taking the advice of other schools is a big way to do that.
Yeah, and that's where, again, talking to those schools is helpful, seeing what they did. Schools in your area that are, you know, similar makeup, you know, how did they handle it and what worked well for them? We've had enough years of deployment, so we have enough data, and people have gone through more than one refresh, and they probably have some strong opinions.
Yeah, and the iPad design has been sufficiently stable for sufficiently long that some of these cases are being quite refined now. You know, the ones for the 9.7-inch iPad, they've been through multiple generations of device and just being updated and refined for each new device as it comes along. So they're starting to be really quite good, some of them. Two last things I wanted to mention, Bradley. One is, if the case comes in multiple different colours, it would be a good idea to get multiple different colours. I think I mentioned this in the last show or the one before, because you know, we have 110 iPads all in a blue and grey case. And it becomes difficult to determine whose is whose. But if you have say a range of four different colours, you put that into a class of 20. You know, there's only so many kids in the class have got a blue iPad or a red iPad or a green iPad or whatever. So it narrows down the search space for identification, if you like, if you can do it by colour. The other thing that the STM Dux case that I mentioned, one thing it's got is on the back, the frame is plastic and the cover is a kind of rubbery material, but the back panel, the panel over where the Apple logo is on the iPad, is actually clear. And this is one thing I'm quite interested in with that iPad, because what you could do is you could put a printed label on the back of the iPad, which would then show through this clear panel, and then you would have a label that was covered by clear plastic, and then you're less likely to lose it.
Yeah, it didn't peel off.
Exactly. So we've put labels on our cases, which eventually fall off because our case is not transparent. But that seemed to me like quite a good idea as well. So I may try that.
That's a good idea. I never thought about that. You basically still get the benefit of the label without like it falling off. Of course, you got to put it on prior to the case going on, but it's not a huge deal.
Yeah, you just have to be a bit careful on deployment day there, because I've always been very careful too. As soon as the iPad comes out of the box, first thing that happens, it goes in a case. But there you're going to have to label it first and then put it in a case. So you want to choose your least clumsy helper to do it. Last thing, Bradley, on case features is that for younger children, I'm talking 4, 5, 6 years old, if you can find a case with a handle, that is a phenomenal help to younger children not to drop their iPad. And we have had zero breaks from those year groups in their entire deployment, mainly because we have used a case that has got a little handle like a suitcase on it. And there's various other kinds of cases that have handles as well. But that's a very, very effective feature for preventing drops. And something to think about.
Yeah, that. I would agree with that. Both of my kids have iPads with handles on them, and they're like on $15 on Amazon. I even posted about it on Tools and Toys a few weeks ago, so we'll drop that link into the show notes. But yeah, it's like a really, really good case.
Very quickly, just some things to avoid in a case. The first one I've put here is it's called Smart Cover, and it's made by Apple. that's a bad sign. Other ones are if there's some part on the case that a child could fiddle with to the point of breaking it or wearing it. And just as an example, our case, is a Belkin case, it has a plastic frame sewn into the back of the case. And then that plastic frame has four clips that go around the corners of the iPad. And what I see kids doing all the time is that they sit and they sort of flick the corner on and off the iPad, right? But what happens is they get interrupted, the teacher tells them to stop it, and the corner's flipped off. And then they never flip it back on again, and the iPad's only being held by three or four corners. So trying to find a case that doesn't have an opportunity to flick or to fiddle with something is quite important. Avoid a case where it's easy to take the iPad in and out. I think our case is a little bit too easy for that. I would ideally like the iPad to stay in the case 99% of the time. Watch out for weight. Those military spec cases can be really, really heavy. But even a kickstand case like ours, the package is quite heavy, and certainly if you pick up an iPad Air 2 now in a thinner case, the fourth generation iPad in this kickstand case is quite a package. And that, of course, has a knock-on effect to the weight of the backpack and so on. And then finally, watch out for cases that don't allow easy positioning for efficient typing. So by efficient typing, I mean sort of wedge-style keyboard typing. And if you give the kids the option, they will probably not do that, so... I'm inclined to force the issue in the next deployment by getting a case that only goes into the wedge position and see how that goes. One last tip. When it comes to cases, you go and buy the case you're going to deploy in the summer in January or February and live with it for those months and see if you can stand it. Back to that discussion about the ethics of deployment. If you can't stand that case, don't put it out for the kids.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, so that's our accessories and apps show. I hope it's useful. I think it's what I've tried to do with these notes in this show is to sort of look at the longer term and try and give you a way to look at whatever comes out that's new, because both in accessories and in apps, there's new things coming out all the time. And if all you know is whether or not Cedar School used it, then how does that help you in the future? Whereas if you look at some of these do's and don'ts for accessories and cases and some of that stuff for apps, you can evaluate yourself what's going to be good without having to necessarily buy it. Because that was something that we saw in the early deployments was we didn't know as teachers how to evaluate an app without putting it in the classroom and trying it. Whereas now we do. We have this sort of mental framework for looking at apps as tools rather than as books. And I think that's a super powerful way to look at the world.
Sounds like a great place to wrap up for this week. Again, this has been episode 6 of our deployment 2016 series. Again, thanks to our sponsors for the week, XMA, EasyGrade for iOS and Mac, and Jamp Software, as always. Again, thanks to our Patreons. If you're interested in sponsoring the show, you can go to patreon.com/howtoschool, and you can chip in $1, $2, $3, or more amount to support the show. We'll be back next week, episode 7 of our deployment series. We're getting close to being halfway done. So if you take a moment, share a link with your friends, colleagues, we certainly would appreciate it. And you can leave us a review on iTunes at itunes.com/outofschool. If you don't follow me on Twitter, I'd love to connect with you. My Twitter name is Bradley Chambers, and my blog is at chambersdaily.com.
Okay, and I am Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web. Thanks for listening, everybody.